One more minute. Hold on.
Daniel, what are you trying to get me to do? Right here? You don't want me to introduce from the dark? I'll do that.
Well, with all that dramatic lighting, I think it's required that we begin. My name's Chris Carlson. You're here at Counterpulse. Counterpulse has been going for about 2.5 years now. It's an art and dance and performance space. It's also a place that hosts a series of talks. And there's a nice yellow calendar. You may have received it in the mail. You might have seen it online. We have 3 Wednesdays a month on dedicated to talks. And the first Wednesdays of the month, called Words First, are spoken word and storytelling performances. So I recommend you check that out as well. We have a great deal of performance going on weekends here, Fridays, Saturdays, often on Sundays. The talk series involves, this is the inaugural night of Art and Politics, which I'll get to in a second, but we normally have on the second Wednesdays of the month talks on the topic of community history and politics. The next one coming up will be on the second Wednesday of October on the topic of the trouble with voting as we come close to another election, a rather meaningless one locally and perhaps always so nationally, internationally, et cetera. We want to have an honest conversation about how disempowered, disenfranchised we are and how absurd the notion of representative democracy is to some of us and others quite meaningful. So that might be an interesting conversation to come and check out. On the last Fridays of the month, we always have a topic under the theme of Nature in the City that we do in collaboration with our pals at Nature in the City. And this month is on the topic of wet infrastructure. How and where should San Francisco get its water? And I'm just teaching a class about this. It's quite fascinating. There's this long history of taking the water from the whole countryside around here, up and down the peninsula, across to the East Bay, and all the way up, of course, to Hetch Hetchy and Yosemite, a dirty and sordid saga that goes on for a better part of a century now, and or even longer. And then there's this amazing story told by Joel Pomerantz in the book The Political Edge about this San Francisco's clean little secret, this amazing bulging aquifer below our feet. So we're going to get into the possibilities of self-sufficiency in water locally and the drama between that aspiration and the rather overwhelming institutional pressure and inertia going towards the concretization and rebuilding of a long earthquake-prone aqueduct system that brings us our lovely fresh water that everybody goes out and buys bottled water instead of because they don't think it's safe for some bizarre reason. So that's coming up at the end of the next week, actually, is that one. Now, tonight we start the series Art and Politics, which I'm extremely excited about. It's sort of been a gleam in the eye for the first couple of years here to think about how could we have more of an integrated approach between the kind of broad cultural initiative that Counterpulse is, which is really about changing life. I mean, you know, whatever else we do around here, and there's many, many things we do, the final purpose of our activities is really to address the deep absurdity of the way we're living together on the planet. And Shaping San Francisco is the project that I do, which is the lost history of San Francisco. And it's really about trying to connect to the amnesiac culture, kind of overcoming that and reconfiguring our sense of how we got where we are and where we might go instead, and since there is a sense of inevitability, which I think is quite inappropriate. Nowhere does this come up more beautifully than in the question of public art. And tonight, we have Mona Caron to come and really inaugurate this series, which is a great pleasure to me. I've been collaborating with her for years. Her murals are famous to you all already, I'm sure, and she's going to give us a really nice, long, sequential insight into how her work has progressed, developed, the thoughts that went into it, the thoughts that didn't go into it, which will now be revealed for the first time ever. And we do have a copy of The Processed World that she did the beautiful cover on. If you haven't seen it up close, please take a look at it during the break. We'll have a brief break at some point, I think, very shortly, and at the end of the night, you can actually get one of these for really cheap, about $5, much less than the cover price. We also have a few copies of the Critical Mass book that Mona did the cover of. And, well, I could blather on for a long time about how talented and great she is and how amazing her art has been in terms of bringing these kind of complex ideas of the society we're in, questions of history, questions of politics, questions of utopia. The actual engagement in her work is really about public space and kind of engaging with the public as she's making these pieces of art has changed many people's lives, maybe some of you right here in this audience. So with all that big buildup, I will hand it off to Mona. She's finishing her glass of water and I'll get her a new one. Mona Caron.
Okay,
Thank you, and hello, and thank you all for coming. Oh, as soon as I'm here, I can't see any of you anymore. But first off, I wanted to see this as a little bonus for coming tonight. You all are going to get a free copy of a Critical Mass poster, which is actually not the original. This is a reprint that was done in Australia of this poster. We just got a shipment of that in from our friend Damon Rayo, whom I hear is back in town soon. So anyway, we're going to have them out. Please grab a copy and enjoy. So there's that. Where? Okay. So, let's start. I'm going to have to warm up a little bit here, so. Starting off, you know what? Am I in the way of the projector?
You want to just look at the screen, forget about it behind you.
Oh, right. I have it in front of me, okay. Oh my God, it's starting well. This was just to plug Puppet Love, which is going to happen here at Counterpulse on October 5th and 6th. This is a poster I did for it many years ago. And just to start off, I just wanted to, instead of going through my work in chronological order, of course I'm not showing everything, but I'm picking a few murals. I'm picking one, sort of an in-between one. This is kind of just to show the general approach I have towards doing murals and the process of doing that, kind of going through that really quickly. This is the Brisbane mural, and I'm being very quaint. I have some analog slides to show you too, so it's kind of, it's not all digital. So let's try and do that switch right now. Let's see. Boom. Is that really dark? It's all right. Okay. So, I do not see that on my screen. God. Anyway, so basically, how's the focus? All murals, of course, start with research, and this is the research for the Brisbane mural was particularly fun to do. This is David Schooley up there, whom some of you know perhaps from talks here at Counterpulse. From San Bruno Mountain Watch, where I sort of went with him to the mountain and learned all about the endangered butterflies and their habitats. Sort of saw, here's a little caterpillar on a flower. Actually, probably there's Deirdre El-Mansoumi in the room, whom I can call upon to fill in the particular details about the botany and the butterfly history here. But so this is my research folder of all the native plants that went into this painting. And this is how I started putting the flowers into the mural. I started with the chiaroscuro painting, which I then glaze over in color on top. So it's kind of like a weird technique. It's not usually done in murals, this kind of double layer technique. So basically, here's the mural. And the way I approach things, especially when I want to include a certain amount of political content in things in the mural that I'm doing for a very friendly community, is I try to do something that appeals to as vast as possible an audience. Like really, mostly my work is not very much about technique in itself. It's really not, I don't think it's ever been or ever will be trendy. It's just, I try to represent things pretty much straightforwardly. And I kind of try to communicate a little bit in symbolic ways. In this case, it's a mural that kind of shows Brisbane in ways that are inversely proportional to the way we normally perceive reality in that particular community. For example, in the center, you'll see the community, the city of Brisbane, sort of protected by the large shape of a mission blue butterfly, sort of which is endangered. And so it's kind of like the opposite, rather than the community protecting the butterfly. And inside, this is a view of the city inside the butterfly. That's Jason Leonard, my assistant at the time. And then I have giant, you know, flowers, as you saw, like native flowers that, again, inversely proportional to the attention that we usually bestow on things that are so small and so fragile. And within that, I have little insets, sepia-toned images that are getting out of focus right now, but which show the development of this area sort of in chronological orders, series views of Brisbane over time. And actually, as you can see, the outside shape of the insets change from the shape of a butterfly to that of a star. Do you see there's a star on the roof here of the building? Brisbane is known for these giant stars that they light up around Christmas time. So it's kind of a symbol of Brisbane. So the change of the frame of these things symbolizes a change from a natural environment to an artificial one or a man-made one. And then it changes shape into a book and into a butterfly again. I'm not going to go very much into detail, but briefly just a close-up of the beginning where you see Ohlone Indians and the eastern side of San Bruno Mountains ending up in the bay before the landfill filled up that area. That would be pretty much the location where the freeway now goes over 80 years worth of dumping into the bay in that particular location. Then you sort of go through the cattle ranch era to, you know, the 30s, the 50s, and to, you know, more recent past. And here you see one where, I don't know if you can tell, but there's a lot of raised hands in an open palm motion, sort of protective of their community. It symbolizes people's active engagement in their community, and they're stopping certain things or attempting to stop certain things that were afflicting their community, including, where's my pointer? Sort of like dumping into the bay, development on top of the San Bruno Mountain, an incinerator being built right in front of them, and also like, you know, traffic from a quarry. This is all very, very small detail, but it's just things to discover in the mural as you go along. This, lastly, represents the present, and at the time, I just wanted to show a contrast between living situations near Brisbane in that particular point in time. Up close, you can see something that I'm going to show you actually a photograph off in just a second. It's a hut built by Besh and Thelma. These were people who had been living in a treehouse for 12 years right above Brisbane. It was really an amazing, amazing, beautiful place that I've been to. And they were being evicted right when I was painting this mural. So I chose to immortalize them in the mural and their beautiful treehouse and showing that in front of the view that they have, which is over the industrial zone in front of Brisbane and of the Eastern Ridge housing developments, which is, you know, actually has a long story about that one, but those are very relatively new condos that were built on the side of an endangered species. That particular case changed the law around native species habitat. And there are streets. The street names are all named after endangered butterflies, but the butterflies are nowhere to be seen anymore. So it's different ways of relating to the land in the way you choose to live in the small community of Brisbane. This is, in the end, the future is represented by drawings that kids did of their town. It's really interesting. This is really where you see the future. It's interesting to see how much centered around streets they depicted their community. It's really all roads. It's like, it's roads everywhere. It's very interesting to discover that. Anyway, so that is just one particular, am I back here? One particular mural, just sort of like for me to warm up. This is Besh and Thelma's actual dwelling. It was a complex of huts, of tree houses. There was really quite a sight to see. This is, over here is Thelma cooking. How's the speed of things? Yeah? Okay. Excuse me? No, they were kicked out exactly when I was painting. That's really what was happening. It was very sad because they were actually really not doing any harm. They were very aware of the environment around them. They had a very sanitary outhouse, etc. They were weeding invasive species and all sorts of things. So it was kind of a sad time, actually. And speaking of sad times, so again, the mural you know, it's I try to show certain contrasts and make certain comments, but it's really very subtle. And I guess I don't want to alienate people right up front by showing an image that is too harsh or something. And I think sometimes I overdo it that way. I think that's like one criticism that I have of myself, is perhaps I'm not just like upfront enough sometimes. But then again, that's really how I can often manage. When I do succeed in that balance, and I manage to at least not talk to an already converted audience and kind of like draw people in that are not already like-minded, and simply by just pretty things, you know, and sort of deliver a message by means of almost like a Trojan horse. So, but then, you know, so why my stuff almost so damn, you know, cheerful? So I have a few things that are maybe less so, because like, I mean, in my bitter moments, I'm definitely get to see things more like this, you know. This is not the only way, but that's just an illustration that I have that depicts what do we have here. I have everything distorted on my screen, so it's very strange. So here you see, like, sometimes I ponder, like, this, in this picture, see the beautiful verticality of this thing that we call a democracy. So it's kind of, like, nicely put, where you see at the very top economic power holding its rightful place, of course, and protected by a couple of cordons of, you know, forces that were created, of course, to defend it. Within a fortress made of, things that are known to really spark people's real engagement, direct engagement with life, sort of like sparking their power of initiative on their own. It's a specific people, sort of probably normally the poorer members of these people are then tasked kind of unfortunate task of defending this entire like system here, or like against the rest of the world here that is given the opportunity to serve it. And then, so at the bottom there's sometimes a little glitch that happens in those situations. I don't know if you can tell the details. Okay. And also then I look around and I see, you know, sometimes like there's, again, one certain class of people that is trying frantically to extract as much wealth as possible from a system that perhaps is kind of like not as stable as it might be. And just this great speed up of trying to do that, meanwhile sort of like consuming resources. While other classes of people are stuck in situations where, you know, they're stuck in places where they have to sell their lifetime doing things really at the surface of the service of globalization, if you will, doing things that are pretty mind splitting. And so in this kind of like more depressed sort of pessimistic vein, I did this one mural. This is actually really fun to do, even though it's like not necessarily very positive. But this was a really fun mural that I did in 2.5 hours in charcoal on paper. I had one piece of charcoal in each hand, and I was just like frantically drawing along. And this piece is called Freeway. And it's kind of like a reflection of which ways are actually free, you know? So it was done with live music, etc., at the Mission Cultural Center. And so it was really done very sketchily. There's the free ways, and it's like, how free are those ways? How free is our view from those ways? That sign, there's billboards all along there. Sign says, take flight, buy shit. And there's like more, you know, whatever. There's trucks, you know, more stuff being delivered to wherever we go. And then all these other things like freeways. And everywhere you look, there's things that actually block your way. You know, there's supposed to be a border. Over here, actually, oops. Over on the side, you see the Palestinian wall, a little bit of it. But anyway, it seems like the entire freeway world is full of barriers, and really perhaps the birds is really the only freeway there is. But then again, those are those moments. Those are the moments. There's another reality that really lives at the same time, that exists at the same time as all these things. So moments, of course, where you can kind of like, you know, throw a monkey wrench into this machine, so to speak. Step on the conveyor belt. And take that gas mask on that we always have on in order to support all these things. And so again, and so I sort of feel like sometimes it seems that there's only one way to go and there's just the direction things are going. But really, I think that the place where I get hope is from all the opportunities that we're given to just like create a different world really amongst ourselves with the things that we do. And create the world that we want to have, like really right now amongst each other. Like we cannot reach out and change the world, you know, the entire world system by our little selves. And even banding together with friends, you can't in a global way. But I think that locally we can really create at least the kind of society that we want to be living in right now. And this is a mural this is the first third of a mural that I did a little bit on that theme on how vital I think that concept is. So this is the left third of the wall, the jungle, and then keep an eye on the water. So then the left third and the middle third and then the right third. So the forest becomes a mural of a forest in the city. And that's a view on end of that. And the water flows and like sort of like spills out where the people come out. It's kind of like the stream of life a little bit, like the kind of thing that nourishes this forest, etc. It's kind of likened to people really directly engaging with each other as being kind of like the water of life of an urban environment of a society. Unmediated action and bonding with each other. This was a private commission by Barry Hermanson, actually, a Green Party candidate. What? It's in a house. You cannot see it. It's outdoors, but not actually visible from the street. But anyway, it's there. It's unpanelable. On panels, it's removable. So a lot of times I've done illustrations that were not like the ones that I kind of depressing ones that I've shown. I try to kind of celebrate and elevate all the things that I see around me that kind of spark that kind of all the things that are, you know, show that life can be much more than simply like selling your time, you know, for money and doing whatever regular life means. It's like whenever people do things that are engaging, that impassion people, and anything that's conducive to a kind of the higher sociability, like or conviviality. Those are the kinds of things that I like to celebrate. And in this case, it's almost kind of gloriously celebrated. And actually, I forgot to say, but see this yellow banner that she's got here? There's kind of like a trope that I throw in every once in a while when I allude to this, when I allude to kind of like idealism and utopian thinking. I've got this yellow banner in it. And it's kind of like the same, like the one that you saw before with Critical Mass, where the street turns over and becomes a yellow banner. That was kind of part of that. I'm still kind of like, sometimes I look around and I see that, unfortunately, you know, more often than not, sometimes we end up just abdicating our power and just registering what amounts to our consumer profile, like we do, like I'm writing here on this illustration. I did this for the Best of the Bay of the Bay Guardian, where for the readers poll. So I was kind of like poking fun at that a little bit, how people are really eager to register their consumer choices, but not necessarily, they don't engage quite as actively necessarily in regular voting or even less so in like other types of direct engagement or direct action. So, but anyway, back to things that actually do engage things, to engage people, and this calavera person is supposed to be me in front of the DuBose Bikeway mural. I was going to show you a little bit of the making of the DuBose Bikeway mural here. Those yellow banners I was talking about, that's kind of like the key of the beginning of the mural. You see Critical Mass here again starting, and I'm pointing to the screen. I keep doing this instead of over here. And off take these, there's this pedal power flying machines, each of them trailing a golden banner, and that golden banner of course symbolizes utopians and dreamers that are envisioning different ways of being in the future. And the whole rest of the mural unfurls as one of these banners. And to get a complete tour of the mural, you should talk to Joel Pomerantz, who is sitting in the front row right here. He gives fantastic tours of the DeVos Bikeway mural, and I highly recommend them. Raise your hand. What? Oh, postcards for sale? Okay, and he's got postcard for sale of the DeVos Bikeway mural. So at this particular time, I was going to show you some slides of another aspect of the DeVos Bikeway mural, not so much its content, but its process a little bit. So let me do that. Oops. Okay. So the DeVos Bikeway mural was my first public mural, and I sort of learned absolutely everything on it in terms of technique. It was kind of a big experiment. But like one of the most important things that I learned was that a big public mural project, like regardless of its content or regardless of its artistic merit, really is able to transform public space in a pretty dramatic way. And I'd say a mural project, I should say, rather than a mural per se, because I don't really have really grand visions of what I can really change in terms of my content of the mural, because I think a lot of people connect to the content and read it as such, but many more people really don't and are more affected by the fact that somebody is inhabiting a public space for a purpose that is like not utilitarian, or is like laboring with a space, putting a lot of energy into something that doesn't really is not for any particular useful purpose and is not commercial. And there's a way in which somehow that breaks barriers, and that's particularly true for certain types of communities, especially like homeless people. They were like a big part of this project here, and all sorts of other communities. Some of them are not usually prone to like reaching out or interacting in a certain way with people. So this project, we started out by physically taking over public space. We had all of the permits, all of the things had gone through City Hall to turn this stretch of DeVos Street into a bikeway and close it to car traffic, except they hadn't done nothing about it. They had put no block there. So we simply put our storage container right into the middle of it. And then we went to the roof of Safeway and we tapped their electricity. And then we went, which is great dance floor, actually. That's the roof of Safeway. It's pretty awesome, you know? That's when I started thinking about like all the kinds of things you could do on the roofs of things. It's like, look at this expanse. It's kind of like, that's me tangoing with Hank Overmeyer. And so anyway, so here was the scene, you know, that we plunked down our storage bin and people working everywhere, and the bicycles, of course, can still go through. So we basically made it happen. We turned this into a bikeway by force, sort of like taking it over this way. And so so again, I learned everything on this mural. These are the extremely puzzling and confusing beginnings. And where sort of volunteers are plugging in, I sort of said, oh yeah, I'm going to do a full finished background with all these, we're going to have an underpainting of different colors. And so people painted different colors, but they didn't blend them. So it ended up looking like this crazy camouflage pattern that was spanning the entire wall. And like, I mean, you know, when you're not used to having people look over your shoulder and look at your work before it's finished, this was it's extremely challenging. I still remember at one point, like this one messenger rode by at full speed. Remember that, Joel? So like, came by really full speed, and I was like, learn how to paint! We're like, oh shit, you know? It's so sad. I was like, no, but please, it's gonna be okay. So that's like afterwards, after we dry brushed over that, it looked better. But it was like so crazy, so discouraging. So that's an up close view of the texture. You can see the camouflage underneath. So anyway, and so there's another thing that was really challenging. These are these things on the wall that Keith and Seth here are putting up are pounce patterns, are like transfer patterns. There's holes in those where the lines are, and then we transfer things. That's another thing that I learned that I never wanted to do again on natural shapes, because like it made them look really stiff, but I didn't know that at the time. So that's what we did. It was really fun to do. Is that Max on top there?
I believe.
Yes, it is. So we have an audience member that's in this slide right now. Anyway, so this is, for the exception of the big bicycle there, that was really crucial to have this kind of technique going on. And you know, that's definitely very useful for this kind of sort of mechanical thing being transferred. And then something about the process here. Like, we had no particular structure to our project, except that, like, I created the design. Joel Pomerantz is the one who spearheaded it and was the coordinator of the project. This is Gordon Dean, who was my main assistant. And everybody else in terms of the art team were people who just organically appeared. First of all, there's 150 people who plugged into this project spontaneously. They just saw it. And people came and volunteered, hey, can I paint? Sure, you know, we can paint. And then organically, out of all these people, some people emerged who were like really kind of got the bug and got really into it. And they kept coming back and started taking on more and more tasks. And this is how the art team was formed, that in the end had six people part of it. And so that's another way in which kind of like you start a big project like that in a public space and things like that just materialize. This is Bill Stender, who was absolutely crucial to this project. He provided the pounce patterns and all in his space to create them. He's a professional sign painter, and he hand-lettered all the credits here, which is insane. And then other ways that people plugged in was really also very spontaneous. You know, I was painting the night sky. I made a white disc on the wall and called it a moon, you know? And then on, you know, along come Joel and Greg and say, that doesn't look like a moon. It's like, what do you mean? It's like a white disc. Yeah, but the craters are wrong and everything. Look, I've got like 6,000 square feet of mural to finish before the rainy season. Do you want to do the moon? It's like, yes. And like, they spent hours and we have an absolutely astronomically correct moon up there. It's like, it's beautiful. It's great. It's like fantastic. You should look at it. It's really quite something. It's probably, I don't know, the best part of that whole section. This is George. George is a bug that came along. That's another way. That's just to remind me to tell you, all this is about this, about what this does when you start a project in a public space. And one day I was drawing, sketching out a bug. Off of the Muni train came this person, really dapper person in an old-fashioned hat and stuff, and said, well, what kind of insect are you drawing? I said, a bug. Well, what kind of bug? Well, it's like one of those black bugs that are on the beach. Oh, because I'm a coleopterist. Would you like my assistance? It's like, perfect, you know, you do it. That's great. It's your project, you know? So it's like people just come out of the woodwork and offer their expertise and the things that they're good at and just plug it into a project in a very organic, very fluid, non-structured way. And so that was the beauty of this project. This is the side of the Muni shelter here has a guest artist painting by Michael Rousseau on it. Also guest artist was Jim Swanson here, who is like artistic representative of the bicycle movement in San Francisco. He did the scowling faces on the corporate buildings there. And then all sorts of things started appearing, all these great posters started appearing on the walls and on the poles nearby, sort of commenting on our themes. So we kept those. There's bunches of stories I could tell about the homeless people. I'm just gonna pick Rick. This guy, Rick, lived against our storage bin. This is his shack, and he was really awesome in so many ways. I don't know if you can read this. It says, spork your bikeway, et cetera, et cetera. Over in the corner there, it says, it ain't the Ponderosa, but it's home sweet home. He was really great and like helped us in all sorts of ways, and it was just really awesome to have him. And like suggested content was like, you know, sort of skateboard dude comes along and says, I'm going to put skateboards. And yes, this alternative transportation, that's fine. Are you going to do a rail slide? I'm like, what's a rail slide? So he demonstrated and I put that in, and later he came by. He said he was fat or something. Anyway. So that's Yekaterina Dabrundashvili next to herself in the mural. I started putting in some friends and like, that's Bambi. That's, he's awesome. Like, you know the location of this is right across the street from the Muni operator's shack, and they were always there like commenting, you know, so like, oh, well, we missed the spot, and you know, we just had them as a chorus throughout the project all these months. In the end, it's like, okay, we need to put one of you in, and like they voted to have Bambi put David Bambury is his real name, and he's actually an inspector from uni, but like, anyway, so we had him put in. He's really great. He brought his mom to the opening, and it was really fun. And other people are, other characters are in here. All of these people are real people that are kind of like movers and shakers of the bicycle community in this particular case. Did I mention this was a project of the San Francisco Bicycle Coalition? This, I just like this shot of the, our fourth attempt at building a roof for rain roof or something. Did this one get torn to shreds by the wind too? I don't remember. And like, so that was the mural within the mural. Actually, anyway, and whatever, skip that. This is Josh Witzke and Joe Pomeranz putting up 6,000 square feet of, not parachute, but like hot air balloon fabric that we hung on the wall for the unveiling. And that's for the, that's for that. So that was like the DuBose bicycle mural. How am I doing? Like, do you wanna, yeah, like.
Well. Hello, yeah, I just wanted to say, lovely event. I'm so happy that Mona's here doing this. It's amazing to get the depth of perception, and I just want to juxtapose that to the, your normal cultural experiences in the world, which are shallow and stupid, and they cost lots of money. This event is not costing you a penny so far. It's absolutely free, and you don't have to pay anything. It's free. We get a little help from City Lights Foundation, and then we just basically pass the hat. Now, I know you've all seen a really bad movie lately for $10. You could pay $10. It would be a cheap price for this amazing, exclusive experience that you're having. And so I'm going to pass the hat around. I hope it comes back bulging with money. I just found out, you know, we wanted to participate in Parking Day on Friday, which is happening all over town. And we're going to take over all the parking places out here. And there's a movement along this little stretch of the street to create a new neighborhood group. We're calling ourselves Planktown Neighbors in commemoration of the old Mission Plank Road that used to run out here. And we wanted to buy planters, and believe it or not, our budget at Counterpulse is so screwed up, we could not afford to spend $100 on a planter. We have no money till the end of the year. So I'm just going to put that out there as I pass the hat. So if you feel rich, help us out. If you don't put anything in the hat. Thanks. Mona, take it away. Also, I just want to tell you also that in that processed world, there's an interview that I did with Mona way back when about the mural that deals with a lot of these same issues and in whole other ways of thinking about it. So. As you get to the end of the night, and if you're interested in that, do check that out and pick one up.
Chris. All right. So, anyway, I'm back. Where was I? Oh, yeah, so that was that. So, really, I was talking about what I was really mostly trying to show with these slides of the process is how. That's what really happens to public space when you engage in it in a way that it is not commercial, that it's really, you know, that's what public art can do. It's kind of like bringing out the best in people in the sense like everybody can plug in their expertise or their passions, everybody can plug in a certain way and sort of sparks people's passions about things. And, you know, I came back from Burning Man. I'm not much of a Burning Man person, but like I went this year. And it was just, once again, it was just so mind-boggling, like the amount of genius, like energy and also unbelievable resources, you know, that get poured into this crazy event that happens in the middle of nowhere for 1 week and then blows up and disappears. Like sometimes I think like, what if their conditions were so that like if we could do this like right here, right now, like people are so brilliant in what they do. If people could just do this all the time, that would just really be fantastic, I find. And yeah, I'm not going to talk about the steampunks. I'm so tempted. I have a few of them here. That's so awesome. But anyway, so next I was going to show the Market Street Railway mural. Where's the thing? And yeah, which is this one on Church and 15th. And this is kind of like has several layers to it. There's kind of like a transit layer about transit history, one about public space. There's several things that go on. It's kind of like sums up a lot of my themes in one, in a way. And one of the things that I do is kind of like using history almost as an argument for a future idealized future vision, you know, because I sort of feel like only if you look at how drastically things have changed over the years, if you look at the past and you realize how different things have changed, that you realize what is actually possible, you know? And so this is, I try to do this at the level of when I talk about the transit history here, what's possible strictly in terms of how we arrange our traffic, you know, but also in other terms, as I'm going to see, show in a second. So I used some, here's some images from Shaping San Francisco in the public library, which is a fantastic resource for my projects, as always. This is Market Street, of course, in the mid-20s, where like four sets of streetcar tracks ran the whole length of it. And it was a very different type of traffic pattern. Also, I used the memory of Sam Yeramian, who's the owner of the building, 92 years old. He remembered riding on the cow catcher bumpers of those trains when he was little. And he was telling me details about that. And so basically, the one key of reading this mural is strictly the transit one. So you would go from this type of reality to the 40s, where the outer tracks have been removed and replaced by diesel buses. Sort of like a disastrous present vision, which is now present at the time. This was 2004. Now there's bike lanes. Yay! And then the future, which has like a whole mix of things in part suggested by passersby. Like, for example, that includes also waterways. Where's my little thingy? There's, you know, water transportation, because, like, you know, either the oceans have risen that far, or perhaps there's daylighting of creeks. I don't know, there's different ways of interpreting that. And basically a whole, you know, range of ways of... I'm not a city planner, I'm not an aspiring traffic planner, and when it shows, like, there's a weird corner there that I think, like, that would just kill a bunch of bicyclists right there, like, just to fall into the water directly. It's like a death trap, like, you know. Why is there... I don't know what was up, but I didn't quite get that right. But anyway... so like, there's all sorts of things that are pedal power blimp, of course, and somebody suggested, how about an elephant? I was like, okay, let's put an elephant. And there are some personal sort of vehicles, and they plug into a sun station here. Like, that's a great thing about being an artist. I can dream up these things. It's up to the engineers to actually figure out how to do that. It's like, it's not my... And so basically these things that we've seen are kind of relate to this initial sketch that I had for a mural, which is very, very simple. It's like it goes from there to the middle to the better future type of thing. And then, of course, I had to muck it up and like make it into more things, which is like more discourse about how we use public space and the street as a public space, and the many, many ranges of the big range of ways in which we can occupy public space. And the many ways that the street is meant to be used. And this was because at the time, actually I'm going to get to that in a bit, but so anyway, many different ways from a celebration like the Gay Day Parade to a formal parade to a demonstration to an all-out police riot, all of these are perfectly justifiable and good ways of using public space. These are the kinds of things that make an urban place a vibrant place where history is made, like, and this is an up close of the parade. I just wanted to show what it's based on. It's the Labor Day parade of that started in 1934, and then it was suppressed during the McCarthy era. Here's the longshoremen marching. This one is based on the 1934 Bloody Thursday. Here's the photographs from that. Then around the present time, this is what was happening when I was painting this. Like, there was these big marches against the war of Iraq that were about to happen. And it's a tribute to Mary Brown, who helped with the, there's definitely, this one is a really crazy part. There's so many figures, and she painted all the pants. It was so awesome. And this is Hugh D'Andrade, whom you absolutely have to come and see his show. He's going to do a show here for Art and Politics series. Going to have in 1 month, so next month he's on. Thanks so much for letting me borrow your pointer. So he painted in all of the signs that people are carrying in the demonstration. It was a crazy amount of work. And so here I'm just picking a few random references. There's a million like people I know or stuff in this mural. There's the Extra Action marching band. There's a Let's see. Over here, there's Samsara. Here's the Committee for Full Enjoyment. That's Eric Drucker, who is also going to show here at CounterPulse. When? In February. So he's going to have his own show. It's really awesome. Here's some of the members of the committee in front of themselves in the mural. Rosie, the Riveters of the Roof. That's me as part of that contingent. Oh, actually, and also Whisper Media on the Roof, filming the whole thing. There's another thing Comet I wanted to make. Hey, it's Jeff, Crazy Jeff from Whisper Media in front of himself in the mural. There's a lot of alternative media going on at the time. There's the indie media guy up in the window filming what's going on. Pod is filming what's going on. And here's the corporate media giving the fair and balanced equal time to the other side of... So. Oh, yeah, that is the little tribute to Frank Chu. He's everywhere, they're ubiquitous, then we love him. And like, so basically there's that. But then in terms of public space, so there's all these different ways of using public space other than traffic and getting to work and shopping and things like that, as I've illustrated. But also, if we sort of backtrack into that present time zone, there's plenty other culture jamming activities that really happen all the time. There's things emerge, like people do things all the time, intervene in their visual space in all sorts of ways. This is a tribute to the BLF, the Billboard Liberation Front. This is a whole bunch of posters, political posters that were being pasted up around that time. I'm even quoting myself. Stencil artists, etc. This is the Reverend Billy of the Church of Stop Shopping. You know, there's all sorts of things. There's plenty of such references there. But really, like, so one thing, this is my opportunity to explain, to sort of voice one thing, that even though I've been drawing trains and bicycles all the time, I'm not really, like, into, like, a transit buff or something. I'm not necessarily a railroad buff or like into, I don't fetishize bicycles or anything like that. Like, the whole transit thing for me is about something else. It's like, in terms of when I try to represent things like this, I sort of feel like when in transit, people, that's the one moment in which people are kind of like outside their normal sphere. Like, they're outside their work sphere, their particular communities. They're really, as they try to get from point A to point B, they enter into this shared space where, like, it's really a shared world of people of all classes, etc. Until they invent special highways for rich people only, I think the streets are really a place that hold a great potential of intermixing and like really shaking things up the way they are. I think in normal life, people are doing a really great job in just staying in their own bubble. You're just like visualizing point B and you're trying to get there. And I actually think that if it were possible to fax yourself to another place or email yourself or like, you know, people would do that. Because like really the time from between point A and point B is just wasted time. And it's just like, you're just trying to get there. But like, it's what you need really. It seems to take a break from the ordinary to get people to actually stop in that space and start mingling and interacting. And when that happens, it's usually a really precious, fantastic moment. Like earthquakes are a great one opportunity for such things. There's like some sort of massive breakdown of the system, some sort of place where all of a sudden you no longer can get to point B, or, you know, but short of such, you know, like really drastic things, but like, you know, other type of interruptions also serve that purpose sometimes, and street art does serve that purpose, whether it's music or other types of things. And I think that a mural project, again, regardless of its content necessarily, sometimes the content might help, but mural projects sometimes do provide a reason for people to stop and interact. And this mural was awesome in that respect, because people just like, you know, people were just... sometimes I would look back and there'd be like a dozen people just looking and sort of talking to each other about what the hell's in the mural. And the way I had started painting that, I'd left, people were getting the idea, oh, it's chronological order, here's the past, here's the present, so this must be the future, what's going to be in the future? And they're starting to have like these arguments about it. And I thought like, okay, at that moment, I've accomplished my mission. Like when that's happening, sort of people just coming home with their grocery bags, et cetera, and start doing that. That's really when what that's the most gratifying moment for me, like from what I do. So I get to be there and experience that and have people like talk about the greater things and about their shared world for once with perfect strangers. That's Sister Gina Tonic. So basically these moments when these things happen, I think are prefigurative of like my ideal future. So like that's the kind of like street life that I want to have. It's a place where the streets are really not just used for transit, but they're inhabited and they're a place of like, you know, artistic and intellectual exchange. And this is a view from the utopian part of the mural. As you can see, instead of the United Nations, I've got United Bioregions and the Bola Bola, etc. There's a, let me see, I got my pointer thing. Guy already ranting against it, you know, and like all sorts of stuff happening. And then, of course, it's a moment in which you bring that Burning Man energy back home into town and like start doing something here along those lines. All sorts of like sharing of resources, San Francisco Swapping Center, the open source tech center, I don't know what else, like all sorts of things I've got. A place where like education happens everywhere, like, and is perhaps free, imagine that, where like people just know a lot, can share their knowledge or their thoughts in free and public ways. And of course, these are dreams, etc. But so there's a lot of references here also to local intellectuals, etc. In fact, the cafe itself is called After the Deluge, not after the Louis XIV quote, but after the title of the novel by this person here, Mr. Chris Carlson, whom you've just seen around here. It was like great, great inspiration and comrade for me for many, many years. This is himself at the Grant Building when he was still there and in front of the Odd Fellows Hall. And it's kind of funny because demonstrations never go down 7th Street, but it worked in the composition. Like, what can I say? So again, a world where all sorts of things are done, resources are shared, and there's plenty of time to relax and enjoy life and build things. Also, I've been doing these kind of like Art Nouveau-ish crazy buildings just to show a place where people put artistry and love and time into everything that they do. That's something that's not economically possible anymore. But just by showing extremely crazy and ornate things, it's that should be supposedly visually indicative of a changed society right there. So that's the utopian section, which I then picked up again when the Guardian called me and said like, hey, we're doing like this issue, it's the best of the Bane, and the theme is San Francisco in the future, and we wanted to be in that place at the end of your mural. I was like, perfect. So like I went on with this particular idea. Here's a close-up of the background of that image. And this is basically like taking place in a future San Francisco that is really tropical with global warming. So vegetation everywhere, and the oceans have risen. And I'm trying to do something where like it's truly in the background, there's a looming disaster, and there's an implication that's pretty horrifying, which is the oceans have risen this much. This would really mean that's really bad news. But how can I then take that and visualize a society that has, however, changed and like taken over what's there, you know, like, and done the best of it. And so here is downtown underwater in the background. I've got a little thing there, a flying machine working. It says powered by photosynthesis. And that's the, oh, that is Rupa and the April Fishes playing in the corners here in, woohoo. And this is also downtown. This was for the sex and romance section. This is for the shopping section. So I put the San Francisco Swapping Center in there again with a five-finger free store. I don't know. And the monkeys are figuring out what to do with money. I don't know if you can. It's like, I think this monk has figured it out. Like you hoard the resources, and this monk is trying to eat it. So, and then there's a whole. This was for the food and wine. It's too long to go through all this, and it's in Spanish. But it's like all these local delicacies. the guy's going out there to kill the chicken. The device on the wrist is the time decelerator. And there's a burning woman instead of a sutra tower. I don't know if you can see the breast, but. And then there's like the public wine utility up there. Anyway. And then all of this stuff, of course, is grown very, very locally, right in the middle of the street. And we've got a little reliquia historica there, like the historic relic of a car. This is at the corner of Folsom and 24th. And yeah, this is for nightlife and entertainment. My original sketch for that was this. But as a kind of more, you know, nightlife and entertainment was a little bit more. But then they felt like it was implicated mass murder, and that was not my point. Those are supposed to be like abandoned warships to show that they're no longer in use anyway. Oh well. So I'm nearing the end here. So to conclude, just have a few more slides, and these are just more for more, you know, there's something to be said also for just dreaming and having more poetic thoughts, like to end the whole slideshow on a poetic note, just ending with this one, which is very, very different than the ones that I showed before. It's a botanical mural, and really it's just showing the beauty of simple things, like showing the intricacy of the most humble of plants. These are just regular sage, like native plants. These two are native plants, but all the other ones are weeds. This is a terrible weed. And these two, actually, these I literally picked off of the cracks of the sidewalk there. Just plucked it up and put them in the mural. Like this thing, it's like, oh, beautiful. And like this weed here, it's terrible. I know they try to annihilate it left and right. But like, just like you can pick any piece of nature and you look at it closely enough. And I just, you know, there's this complexity and there's beauty there. It doesn't need to be precious. This is me taking a picture of an evil, invasive, non-native species, the wild radish, which is even that is like has amazing complexity to it. And also, I also included litter, sort of like a botanical litter from the street that was being swept up, like this magnolia bud, like right here. And, you know, shepherd's purse, whatnot. And just like to try and cultivate that kinds of sensitivity towards things, towards the value and beauty of things, regardless of their monetary value, or regardless of, you know, the kind of like things, the value that fetishization brings about in them. So being open-hearted towards things. And that concludes my presentation. Thank you very much for your like. Is that too long?
We'll go ahead and if you could bring the house lights up a little bit so we can all see each other. Of course, this is your really special and rare opportunity to get inside of Mona's head. She's here to answer all your questions, whatever they might be. So I would throw it open to you, the audience. You might have something interesting to say about what you saw. You might want to ask her questions that she didn't answer. You might want to just propose new ideas for her or the rest of us to think about how we think about life. Who'd like to jump in first? Okay, I'll ask you all to speak into the mic because we're actually recording this for future posterity and our own interest, and it's a good way to regulate talking.
Thank you for your talk. I was wondering, what is it about the extreme perspectives and the kind of sense of falling in all of your images or in a lot of your murals? What captivates you about that?
I never thought of it as a sense of falling. I always saw it as a sense of flying. Yeah. But it's beautiful though, wow. What is it? It's just like this fantasy of being able to have this sweeping view over the whole situation, you know, like this moment in which you have like this grandiose idea of trying to encompass it all and trying to see it all and put it all in perspective, like quite literally, you know? So in the case of the Market Street Railway mural, like, you look left and right, you look back into the past, you look forward into the future, sort of like, and I do that in my mind, and so I'll just draw that so that that's possible in one image. Yeah. Is that it? Okay. Yeah.
Well, I'll ask you a quick question, which,
yes.
You spoke at the beginning about how you sort of feel like perhaps you've been I don't know, I will use the word vanilla. I don't think it's accurate at all, but that you've soft-pedaled your politics a lot, mm-hmm. and that you somehow you were being a little self-critical at the start of the yeah. of the talk, and I thought that was interesting to hear from you after our many conversations about this over the years. I'm wondering, what has been your interesting anecdotes of receiving hateful responses to your work? Has anybody figured out what your real mission is here? Because I think you gave us a lot of insight into it tonight in a way that the average person on the street seeing your murals might not totally pick up on. Has anybody gotten inside of it and come after you a little bit, verbally?
I remember this one, the Marcus River Railway mural had a comments book. And one comment was like, something like, sort of, nice, sort of kind of nice painting, a little bit too comunista, or something like that, a bit too communist. It's like a nice painting, except it's a bit too communist, or something like that. I haven't really had hateful responses, fortunately. But like people would sometimes pick up on things that way, sort of like, oh, nice painting, too bad it's. Did you have to include that, you know? It's like they see it as a little flaw, like overall they like it, but it's too bad that I had to put that in, you know, kind of thing. So no, I didn't, yeah.
Thank you, Mona.
Hey.
Hi. Your paintings have a lot of movement in them, and I know you are also a dancer, and I've also seen, or you dance, and I've seen you paint here, actually, at a Slow Food event and at the Great American Music Hall, where you were very much dancing while you were painting. I was wondering if you have any paintings of dancers. That's it, simple.
No. In the streets, maybe little figures. Oh, I think I have maybe some really old works, but no, that's a good point. I should do that. I should remedy that. Thank you. It's important to dance. I love dancing. Yeah, it's true. You know what, though? Like, the way I illustrate the botanicals that I do, I think of them as dancing, though. Like, I have them do something that is only partially naturalistic. Like, some of it, like, it's kind of rendered as if they're real, but they're not really. I'm making them do things. Like, I call them gestures. You know, the leaves, they kind of go like that, because I kind of felt like... So, I mean, I get that's the best dancers that I've probably illustrated, but, yeah.
You make me think of some friends of mine from Switzerland as well, poster artists. And one of the things they critique this culture for is the lack of the voice for the pedestrian voice. We've either got the huge billboards, or else you get slapped with a fine if you put anything over, whatever, 11 by 17 on a pole. And so I wonder about your space. It's funny to me that you're Swiss as well, coming from a culture where there's a louder public voice, larger poster sizes allowed. Mm-hmm. But I wonder, do you conceive of yourself as sort of filling that non-corporate billboard voice? Filling a large space?
Well, definitely the non-corporate billboard voice, for sure. I didn't actually even know that about Switzerland, what you just told me, about the larger poster sizes. There's a law around that? Okay. I wasn't aware. Uh-huh. So I think I come to that, but not by virtue of being Swiss, because I wasn't aware of that particular fact, but definitely a sort of like, showing before, I'm all for, and I could fully support any type of alteration of our visual landscape, especially the part of it that is commercial. I sort of feel like it's, you know, like the amount of visual space that these giant billboards take up, and how insidious they are within our consciousness is just something kind of quite offensive. And I feel like all that space should be taken over by art, or not have anything, not have any billboards, and allow some sky, you know? Just some sky, some ocean. That'd be nice, you know? Like, those kinds of places should not have anything. But otherwise, like, have a room for people to express and communicate visually is just one of the many ways you can, but it's definitely one way.
I wonder if I could ask you to follow up on that, because it's one of the missions of Shaping San Francisco, of course, is to reconnect us to history, and your murals do such a nice job of that. But it's a very interesting coincidence, I guess is the best word for it, is that you're from the same small town as a muralist who got here 100 years ago, Piazzone, and you actually went out and did some sort of a live muraling in the room at the De Young where the murals that were originally in the old library got moved. And those are murals that are very open, very large, full of sky. Perhaps you could just speak about your connection to place as where you came from and how you addressed yourself to the Piazzone relationship at that moment in the De Young.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, unfortunately, I didn't have any pictures of that, but yeah, I did that. Should I describe what I did? Or? Okay, so basically, 100 years ago, let me backtrack. The old public library, which is now the Asian Art Museum, used to have these murals on their walls, sort of like of the 30s. They were then removed and put into the De Young Museum eventually to have their own room. And I read on the newspaper that the name of the artist was Gottardo Piazzone. I thought, like, that guy's gotta be Swiss. You know, like Gottardo, no Italian is going to be called Gottardo. So I did my research, and sure enough, he not only was he Swiss Italian like me, but he came from the same. I come from the middle of nowhere, people. I come from like this village, actually, even outside of a village. Now it's much more, I mean, things have changed a lot since I've moved away, but it used to be this tiny place of like 800 people. And back in the 1930s, yeah, it was like less than that. And so that's where he was from the very same mountain village as myself in Switzerland. And so what I did at the De Young, so I went to see his landscapes. He did landscapes, and they're really very vast and very horizontal, sort of very sparse, and it was so trippy to me because where we're from, it's the exact opposite. It's like super vertical canyons, you know, it's like this claustrophobic kind of like experience. And I thought that he must have blown his mind coming here to California after that landscape and go like, oh my God, pastures to go on, and like all this. And I think it, like, that's what happened. It just like it couldn't stop like doing these, you know, nice and vast expanses of things. So at the De Young, I did a response to his 5 paneled pieces by, in front of each panel on the floor, with charcoal, I drew scenes from Intragna, which is the name of this village that I'm from. They're super, super vertical, you know, the views of the 7 bridges that lead to the hill where the village is perched. And
I have this question for you, Mona, and I it may not even be relevant to you, but I imagine it is, but just entertain it and see if it is. Okay. I think a lot of times when artists do public art and art that's participatory and more democratic art, there can be a tension between the artist's individual vision and what they want and what maybe the public wants, mm-hmm. or in your case, maybe the funders, whoever's funding your particular mural. Mm-hmm. And I just want to know if that's a relevant tension for you, and if it is, how you deal with that tension.
Mm-hmm. It's extremely relevant. It's extremely relevant. And the way I deal with it is depending on the situation. One thing I need to confess that the process in my murals is really not that democratic. And like even in the case of the Vos Bikeway mural, which is the one where the most people plugged in, I mean, I did the design and the really like there was this organic way in which people came to the art team because they actually genuinely shared that vision and they sort of materialized and came together that way. And it wasn't just a question of like, I think that's much better than trying to interview people and see what skills they have. It doesn't matter what your skills are. It's like, do we sync on our vision? Do we also communicate? Are we simpatico? Do we like each other? Do we like being around each other? Do we like our energies? And I think that's a way that just ends up working so well when things just coalesce that way, when things just come together kind of naturally that way. So that's one. In terms of like funders, since like these public murals that I showed, at least in San Francisco, they're city money, I don't feel any restrictions whatsoever. The one thing with the Market Street Railway mural, it was written into the grant that it was going to be about the Market Street Railway. But how? That was up to me. And I did make it up about the Market Street Railway, but about much more than that that interests me. You know, as I was saying, I'm not a railroad buff, but I love this incredible change that happened on Market Street, et cetera, et cetera, you know? So it's like I find ways of kind of like, you know, going with that. Since then, like the grants were written with me collaborating on that. So I basically get to do whatever I want. And in terms of private commission, I kind of do the same thing. I sort of say like if you just want a hand, you know, like I can recommend, you know, there's many other people that could do that. Like if they want to hire me, it's like I like to come up with an idea, and you give me a theme, you give me anything, and then I'll come up with something, and then we'll talk about it, you know. So there's way of which, yeah, I think that's what I'm about, is about coming up with certain concepts, and people would hire me because they like that, not because they're fighting against that, you know. And I put that up front.
I want to just ask one follow-up question, just so we understand the process. When you get a commission, say, with the transit mural, or I'm even thinking now of the one that you did out at down south in Brisbane, do you show the people that are funding the sketches, and do they approve it, or do they say, you have free reign, do whatever you want?
In San Francisco, the sketches go through an approval process by the Arts Commission. As far as I can tell, they don't even look at the stuff. They go like, oh, public mural, all right, approved, next. Like, I'm not sure, but I think that's the case. Like, they don't...
There's a case right now with that mural on the
Which one?
Get the microphone and speak about that, if you would. If somebody knows, if you know the details better...
But I believe that it's being made by a group of students through HOMI, and it's a 24th and Cap.
I know HOMI.
And they've got a website where they've got all the photographs, and there's one section that's controversial, and it seems like some Israeli or Jewish anti-defamation groups are attacking them because it's apparently glamorizing Palestinian activism, and the suppression of the people and the people trying to rise up.
Right.
So that's what's going on there.
Okay, so then that was a complaint coming from someone. Like somebody actually lodged a complaint. So that's a different thing.
The theme is borders, actually, and they actually have this whole idea of breaking through the borders, and there's a series of border-like representations along the series of panels in the mural. And the last one is the wall being built by Israel into Palestinian territory and showing that's Palestinians breaking through the wall, which is what's pissing off the Zionists in town. And they're trying to stop that mural and get its funding defunded, essentially. That's been what's going on. It's largely finished, but there's still some more to do on it. Let's go for Carl, the next question.
Hi, Mona. when I saw your series in the Bay Guardian, I couldn't help but be reminded of some scenes from Chris's book. And I was just wondering about the timing and how that all played out when you did the sketches and how inspired you were from Chris's book, et cetera.
There are deliberate references to Chris's book in there. Not exactly to Chris in particular, like in the case of, I could go back a few. The sex and romance one with, I don't think I can find. Okay, there it is. Like these walruses are a particular detail that exists on Halleck Street downtown, this little back alley. It's like smells like piss, etc. Nobody goes there, but there's this amazing like bas relief sculptures. There's of walruses. That Chris maybe can say, but basically it's something that Chris always likes to point out in his tours downtown. So I was definitely, those were nods to Chris. There's many nods to Chris all over my work. Now, the thing about the utopian future, and that's something that I actually have, I've always thought that way. That's one of the things that Chris and I have collaborated and agreed on very much, is kind of like this need of visualizing the future, sort of visualizing have positive visualization of the future. And like I've always dreamt, you know, I have this on occasion extremely vivid architectural dreams, like really, really in detail and usually really colossal and on crazy perspectives. I dream that way sometimes. And so like some of this stuff corresponds to that. And like the mixture of nature with architecture, that's something that's been with me since I was a teenager. And certain things that influenced that was a novel by Franz Hohler, who is an amazing, means something else. He's an actor and a writer, a political performer, a fantastic guy who wrote a novel, sort of like a science fiction novel called Die Rückeroberung, which means the take back, you know, where slowly but surely nature comes back And the characters at the beginning don't notice, but it sort of becomes more and more noticeable. But oh my God, like nature's taking over again and coming back and reclaiming everything. And it's something that I read when I was maybe 13 or something. And I loved it. And like, I just started drawing like plants taking over cities. And that's been with me the whole time, you know? So like that kind of thing is with me. But like the fact that the oceans may be rising, that has been out. And so my favorite part of Chris's novel is the, I mean, there's several, but like at the very beginning when you enter the city and you see what's going on, you know, I've been wanting to illustrate that too. So yeah, the timing of that is like his novel came out first.
04.
Well, it was at the same time. The novel came out at the same time, and the title of the novel is in the mural. Oh no, you're saying The Guardian. So like, yeah, that was after for sure. This was a little wordy. I don't know. Did that answer you?
I'll give you a quick take on that. It's worth just noting, since we're talking about history as much as we're talking about art and politics and public space, I was turned on by the really great local historian Gray Brecken to the story of those cement walruses that are the last remnants of what was once the Alaska Commercial Corporation headquarters there, where there's now the Union Bank building. And it's a, you know, a long story. I can tell you a lot of different details, but the really fast and brutal version is that San Francisco's founded on the rapacious exploitation of the natural world all over the West. And there was a company founded in 1860s, I believe, the Alaska Commercial Corporation, which was given an exclusive contract to mine the living mammals of the Pribilof Islands, all the seals and walruses and whatever else was there. Plus, we were also a huge whaling port during this whole time. So there's this process, and the Alaska Commercial Corporation was, according to Gray's work, the de facto government for the entire West, like all the way up through Idaho, Montana, the Washington Territory, Oregon, west side of Canada, Alaska, out into the Pacific, across, down the coasts, you know, into the Americas. And you know, essentially what they did is they just took everything that was alive and treated it as a giant mine and turned it into capital. And then capital, of course, is dead labor, it's dead life. And it turned it in not only to but it then physically they embodied it on their building. So up until 1975, there was a building at that place on California Street covered in cement animals that this company had essentially been exploiting for all those years. So you could never find a more poignant and overwhelmingly brutal metaphor for how capitalism operates than that those last remnant sculptures of walruses down there. So it's nice to see the sea lions coming back to San Francisco on Pier 39, which they just took back all that good real estate, and hopefully someday they'll take back downtown too.
Someday there will be a battery in Halleck.
That's right. Who's next? Well, I'll ask you another question. Oh, there's Sean's ready. Let's go for that.
I guess this is sort of another edge of what you've been talking about in terms of the utopian imaginary and all that. And it goes back to a conversation we had once where you were reflecting on a prospective mural in the Tenderloin where you were really challenged by the issue of how do I not be sort of, as I remember you saying, Pollyannish and in a sense, you know, a utopian representationalist or whatever and deal.
Uh-huh. Well, actually, that exactly like the distinction of the two, what I don't want to do is like a sort of disingenuous idealization of the present. What I can't stand is like, oh, look, we actually don't have all these problems. We're all a bunch of happy people having wonderful lives. And it's kind of, no. It's like, I think that's precisely the difference between doing that and showing an obviously, obviously utopian, maybe I shouldn't be using that word, but like a future vision to clearly go like, okay, this isn't now. This is another tomorrow. And sort of, I think that's a way of really challenging people to think more about more drastic change rather than trying to represent a present that's glossed over, to actually go like, no, actually we could do something very different. And I think in the case of the Tenderloin mural that's going to come up next year, I want to do something like that. And you know, it's going to be super challenging because I want to show like a neighborhood that is transformed positively but avoid any types of things that like smack of gentrification. So any type of beautification that is kind of like this thing that just, you know, yeah, that that smacks of that, but rather have a change that looks very much DIY, that where you can see the population is the extant population of the Tenderloin that's just taken initiatives and has changed things themselves. And in order to do that, I want to set it in the future to like suggest like radical things you could do there, you know, if it were up to you and using the means that you have at your disposal, if there were no barriers. If today you could just decide, you know what, in this lot, this is what I'm going to do. Hey, you guys help me? Okay, let's just do that, you know? Like, that's the kind of thing I want to be doing, yeah.
Hello, Mona.
Hi.
Your work is very inspiring to me personally, and I know to many people in this room, but I want to talk more about that Tenderloin mural. Are you going to be consulting or meeting with the residents in that neighborhood?
Yeah.
And how will that process occur for you, as you imagine?
I'm a little nervous to talk about it because it's really the beginning stages and it's like not at all set in stone yet, but I'm talking with neighborhood groups there who are awesome, really, really awesome, politically great. I'm very, very excited about it. I don't want to go on too much about it because it's not totally secured, but definitely. Yes, and there's ways in which plugging in directly with the people that really inhabit that particular corner, you know, and, you know, making ties with really the people who inhabit that. I'm not going to specify how, but you can imagine, you know. So, but yeah, that's definitely part of it.
I want to put in a plug for something we're doing. I'm Joel Pomerance, and I'm the project manager for a couple of these murals, including the one that Mona's doing right now in Noe Valley.
Yeah.
The Noe Valley mural is a two-part mural. We've just started it a few days ago, and it'll be this fall and next spring, two murals facing each other across the parking lot that the farmers market is held in on Saturdays at Sanchez, between Sanchez and Vicksburg on 24th Street. We're doing a fundraiser at some point. We don't have a date, but if you're interested in coming, one of the fundraisers that we're planning to do for that mural includes an opportunity to go to Barry Hermanson's house and see the mural in his house, one of the rare opportunities to see Mona's mural at his house. He's also making some of his homemade beer for it. And I'll happily collect information of anybody who wants an invitation to that fundraiser. I also have a question for you, Mona.
Yeah.
And that is, how does your choice of colors, what's your process for choice of colors having to do with what kind of message or what kind of feeling you want the piece to bring? How do you do that color choice?
Well, the color always gives kind of like an emotional underscore to an image, you know, like there's obvious things such as like the warmth or perception of warmth or perception of cool that happens that it just influences you on an emotional level as well. That's kind of like the way, the subliminal way that any type of visual representation talks, whether it's art or advertisement or anything or movies or anything like that. So I use that. I try to use that. Sometimes I make mistakes, but I try to use it that way. There's the background with the warmth. And are you saying the paint?
Yeah.
Oh, well, the botanical mural background was painted in, let me fast forward it. Sorry. It was extremely complicated to do this painting. Lisa Ruth Elliott, who is sitting here in the front row, is my fantastic art assistant who is helping me on my current mural projects as well. So she and I mostly have painted this background, which consists of a background of vertical streaks and then a dry brush texture over it. The reason we did that is because this wall is actually really messed up and we didn't really prep it very carefully, which means that it will deteriorate And the way it will deteriorate, we already knew how. Above there, there's a rusty fence, and rust will leak down from above. There's dirt that was going to trickle down from above, and water that's going to trickle down from above. And we figured, like, let's just go with that. Let's just go with the decay and work with it rather than against it, and like have these vertical streaks that will look good with rust, you know? And like sort of like cracks and things like that. And as things leak down the wall, it'll actually look good, you know? So that's... that was kind of the thought behind that.
I was going to... Oh, here's somebody else. Let's go. That gentleman's next. You're first, and then he goes.
Yeah, that's actually a perfect lead for the question that I had, which wasn't so much about rust or natural decay of a public art space, but I want to hear a little bit about what you've experienced in terms of vandalism or maybe a purchased building having murals erased by a new owner, or just your take on what mm-hmm. your work has experienced or could experience in the kind of the urban decay and the challenges, mm-hmm. especially when you're doing political work.
Yeah. Well, fortunately, knock on wood, I haven't had too many problems with tagging or graffiti, with the exception of a particular part of the DuBois Spikeway mural, which is like keeps getting tagged for good reason. It's like totally my fault. Like I put like this Muni train in the DuBois Spikeway mural, perfectly clean and new. It's like, what was I thinking? You know, it needs to have graffiti over it. Like, I mean, of course, rightfully so. Like, so people are tagging it. Something's obviously missing. I should have done something about that, you know? But like, otherwise, like there's just wear and tear. There's all sorts of like liquids that end up sticking to the wall that need to be cleaned off every once in a while and things like that. So relatively few problems with graffiti, really. I'm waiting for them to just crumble and fall apart. And like this one is going to crumble fast, really fast. The botanical one. I shouldn't be saying that. I realize. I bite my tongue. Okay, I think.
Mona.
Oops. yes.
Beautiful work.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, thank you. Do you know of a map or list of murals in San Francisco that we could find?
Presida Eyes, probably.
Presida Eyes.
Yeah.
Online.
Anyone else? Presida Eyes, probably. You know about them? And Presida Eyes is a muralist association on 24th Street. They have their office, 24th and Treat. Bryant? Harrison? Oops. yeah, somewhere around there. And yeah, you look them up, Presida Eyes. Okay. And they do mural tours. Oops, that's my phone. And things like that. And also check out Joel's mural tours. Also right, this person right here. And also Joel does these amazing tours of the city too on a particular sort of political slant, may I say that? Like sort of like interesting views and things. And they're called Think Walks, yes. And that's the website for that is ThinkWalks. Dud.
All of them, com.org.
Oh,
net,
everything, I see. Yeah, yeah, okay.
So yeah, that's a couple places you can find out. I also would say that I'm gonna do a bicycle history tour on the subject of transportation through the city this Sunday at 12 o'clock right here at CounterPulse. So if you're interested in that, come on along for 4 hours. We have two copies of that. You want to keep them for yourself? We have two special copies that have been, okay, that's fine. These have been donated tonight to be special gifts for somebody who asked some really zinger question that we're really happy about. So Mona's going to choose based on questions, or I will if she doesn't, who gets the only two copies of CounterPulse Zine, which happened in the interregnum between the evictions that we went through as 848 and my old office space when I was moving out of there at the Grant Building and moving into here. There was about a year and a half or 2 years where we were trying to keep the concept alive and thought up the name CounterPulse, and we made this zine, and there's an interview with Mona in there, an article by her actually, and some amazing renditions of her art. So ask a great question, maybe you win a magazine.
Well, they already did
that. I know. It's too bad for all you guys that asked all those great questions already. You'll just have to remind us that you deserve a magazine, and that'll be fine. I want to ask you a question, which a little bit comes out of the reference to Persida Eyes, but I want to back up a little bit. There's a very strong legacy of muraling in San Francisco, going back not just to Piazzone, but also to the Panama Pacific International Exposition. And then Diego Rivera is brought here in the 20s and ends up having quite an impact on radical muralists, communists, and others who leave a great legacy with us in the Coit Tower murals, in the ones in the Rincon Annex. Diego Rivera himself has three different murals here in the city, one at the Art Institute, one out at City College, and one at the City Club. And these are very powerful pieces of art, and I know that you've actually checked them out and actually went to visit some Diego and Frida Kahlo stuff down in Mexico. And I want to just find out from you a little bit about how you situate your own style artistically in terms of the trajectory of the history of muraling in San Francisco, and particularly how different you are. Like, you're quite unique. I don't see any other muralist going, oh, I'm going to paint like Mona Caron, which surprises me because you've really pioneered a very interesting style, and there's things that set yours apart from the other murals.
Okay,
in town.
I think that it's a little premature to put me on a continuum with like Diego Rivera. That's okay. Pretty ridiculous.
Well,
but like all I can say is, of course, like huge inspiration. And my appreciation of Diego Rivera really exploded when I went to the Palacio Nacional in the DF in the Mexico City. That's when it really blew my mind because of the color that he used, and it was just exquisite and beautiful, and kind of a way that, I don't know, the way I think color too, I was kind of like, oh, I understand.
In terms of your relationship to other muralists in town right now and the style that you've made for yourself, which is quite different than other muralists, and what maybe you could speak.
Well, the thing is, like, I'm not, you know, as I was saying, I'm permanently out of fashion. It's like, I'm really just trying to tell a story. I'm really an illustrator first. I went to art school to be an illustrator. The illustrator is somebody who works with text and it does narrative, or actually not necessarily, but often the field of illustration attracts people like me who like to tell stories visually, you know? And so, really, I usually just go for it in the most straightforward way that I know. I mean, where this feels more natural to me. And I realize often I have tremendous doubts, like self-doubt in that way, in terms of like not being more innovating in style and trying to do something. I don't know, just like trying to innovate formally. I never try to innovate formally. I always try to tell a story first. And the style is, I don't see it, it just happens. Whatever happens, happens, you know? And I think that's also what will keep me safely away from the category of fine art, right? But like never be in there, because I think it's, that's that. Like really, that's also a way in which I define myself as a artist. Whatever that means, it's kind of like, being situated in the street or on things that are used, posters, flyers, things like that, things that are not precious, things that are accessible to all, are cheap, and not like basically not in a pristine white gallery space where I think that the price tag on the paintings are always part of the art. They become part of the conceptual aspect of the art, no matter whether it's intended or not. Like there's something that happens to the painting. It is affected by the price tag or by the situation in a gallery, and by the wine and cheese also affects it, you know? Like, do you know what I'm talking about? It's like, it's kind of like, it's just something that, it's not me. That's it.
More questions? More thoughts? Chance to win a magazine?
I think they all won the magazine.
Yeah, I know.
But like, you can just share a page each.
All right, here comes Howard with a question.
Okay. I want to win the magazine.
Have you ever illustrated books, or maybe perhaps Chris's next novel or his next edition of his novel?
I don't know. Books? Yes, I got for you, Howard. I brought you your book.
Thank you.
I have a children's book that I illustrated. And this is your copy. Yeah, and I've illustrated other books as well, yes. And as an illustrator, of course, yeah. And Chris's novel, no. No. I kind of did, sort of, in The Bay Guardian.
Yeah.
A little bit.
But just as a follow-up, when... Okay, in what you just previously said, now, when a illustration goes into a book, to compare it with what you said earlier about the price tag on a painting, there is a price tag, unfortunately, on the book.
Of course.
So how do you see the relationship there?
Uh-huh. Well, a book costs, like, what, $13 or something like that? And 20? No, no, this is free for him, but, oops, no, but, no, as an illustrator, I do commercial art. I mean, it goes on stuff that gets sold, I guess, not necessarily on poster too, but really it's stuff that's utilized, you know, posters, they're cheap, they're thrown away, they're used or kept. I try to make posters that are keepers, you know, but they are on things that are out there in the world that way. So yeah, and this is how I make a living, by the way. Like, this is all I do, I draw and paint. And yeah, there's that. But I try to, like, I mean, the public mural art is more like, that doesn't cost anything to go look at, and you just, you know, check it out that way. Yeah. And plus, you know, if you come to talks here at Counterpulse, you get freebies. Anyway.
Anybody else?
Yep, there's one.
So, hey. there seems to be that your answer to all the negative response questions is like, I never had any.
Well,
or
not
sort
really.
Of like.
Not, I didn't have any hate.
Yeah.
Like,
which is unique,
attacks.
I think. Because it seems that your style is very beautiful and does not draw that kind of energy, especially all the utopian kind of like things that are happy to think of. You do talk about like a not such a perfect present, but like I know that you have some work. I don't know. I missed some of the beginning. So maybe you went through some of your dystopian.
Yeah, I did a little bit.
Dystopian works that are not up on walls.
Mm-hmm.
I know. I wonder if, like, if you have a thought about, like, how the need for a positive future to be presented on walls, etc. Nobody's gonna pay for a, you know, a dystopian, depressing, horrible future to be put on their house, and how, like. Just like what do you think about that? Like how does that change? What does that say about our present, where like nobody wants to really look at the possible dystopian nightmare that is possibly coming? And are you intentionally trying to avoid it?
No, I'm not intentionally trying to avoid it at all. And I don't think I do. I mean, I do plenty of illustrations that way. But I think it's all around us, no? I mean, the way the world is going to hell in a handbasket, I think, is up. Like, that's very much being talked about. I think what's far more rare is people who have the guts to sincerely... to really sincerely, not ironically, but really sincerely kind of like envision something beautiful. Because like, you know, you run the risk of seeming like Pollyannish or trite or like, oh God, and it's more rainbows and pretty flowers and like yawn, you know. It's also, I think, even safer as an artist to be kind of negative because it's more edgy. It kind of, you know, it's kind of like this kind of, thing is, it's, I think it's extremely hard, you know, to try and inspire people to, you know, to not just visualize, but like incite them to create a better future right now with the tools that you do have, you know? It's so easy to fall into the trap of trite, you know, rainbowy little hearts floating type of things that nobody will take seriously, or, you know? And I mean, I do a lot of, you know, the way I often deal with that, I try to deal with that, I throw in humor, you know? It's like, sometimes I just make it a little funny where you go like, oh yeah, right, like as if that's ever going to happen. But like, so there's a little bit of that, like just to show that I'm really conscious of the risk I'm running here with my sincerity, because I'm totally sincere with these things. I really think that we can, like the kinds of things that we really, I feel need to envision is changing the world, not in the utopian sense of the word of utopia that means a totalitarian raising to the ground of the reality the way it is and build the perfect society right here in a Stalinian kind of way, you know, but a utopian sort of vision that makes use of what we've got, whatever we've got, the buildings that we have, build on top of them, you know, build bridges between them, do something with them, run with what you've got. You've got the oceans rises, great, like run with that. What are you gonna do with that? So great, it's gonna be like Venice downtown. Like let's make that into something beautiful. Just whatever happens, whatever is there, just use that and make it great. And I think that we have the potential to do that. And like I see it all the time. I see it all the time. Unfortunately, limited into safe little festivals someplace where people bring their unbelievable skills and energy and expertise to build something from the ground up. Burning Man, you know what I mean? Instead of like doing it right here, if everybody did that, like we could be there now, you know? And I don't know, that's how I feel about it. Here's my rant for today. Yeah.
All right, I think we might have had a wonderful evening here. You're welcome to hang out and keep chatting and hang out with each other and keep the conversations going. I do want to give one more pitch for a CounterPulse event coming up, which is a Shaping San Francisco event also. October 21st will be the next Slow Food Feast of Fools and Friends, which is an incredibly artistic experience with an amazing meal right in the heart of it. We have it right here. We have about 80 seats available. There's still lots of tickets available. You can get them online. It's a performances. In fact, Mona painted a live mural last time. Rupa and the Fishes were here. April Fishes were here singing and playing amazing music, and a wonderful feast unrolled. And it's an amazingly multi-layered event. So I think if you haven't experienced it before, you don't want to miss it. The theme this time is moving foods. How did all the food that we eat, the California cuisine, get here? Who brought it? What are the cultures that brought it? How were they treated when they brought it here? And we'll have a meal that takes part mostly of Mexican and Southeast Asian cuisine. And typically we show a lot of videos and you get to meet the farmers who are actually taking the food out of the ground and see where they are and find out how local it is. And that's really our goal with that event, is to connect ourselves as urban residents with local food production and really renew the relationships to the local ecology, the ones that we make affirmatively for the present and the future. So please join us for that if you're so inclined. We'd love to have you. And of course, next week is the talk on wet infrastructure, where and how do we get our water here in San Francisco. So we're trying to really connect ourselves to the world around us and under our feet. I hope you'll come back next week and weeks to come. Hugh D'Andrade, who's sitting up in the audience, will be the next artist featured in the Art and Politics series at the third Wednesday in October. I think it's the 19th, right? 17th. So you can check our calendar. There's a big, beautiful yellow calendar out there, which he designed also. And please come back again. Thanks for coming. And give us your audience response forms too, please. We'd love to hear what you think. And if you get on our mailing list by just putting your email on here, we'll send you updates on what we're doing. Thank you for coming.
Thank you.